Pat mentioned I'm going to be talking about how does one measure success when one thinks about preventive action. But I'd like to start with just two prefatory comments. First, assessing the risks and challenges of preventive military action against Iran's nuclear program is perhaps the most difficult analytical challenge I've had to contend with in my professional career due to the uncertainties, military technical and policy challenges, and just the stakes involved. It's an extraordinarily complex problem. Now, with regard to reading our report, I'd just like to start off and say a few bottom lines here. First, as Patrick said before, I think, you know, we are in agreement that diplomacy is by far the best option right now, or at least for as long as it offers even a modest chance of success. And I would say I'm a little less sanguine than Patrick on this regard. I think diplomacy has the potential to succeed if we were to able to get the international community mobilized and more exercised on this issue. I just have questions whether we'll be able to reach that point. Nevertheless, sometime soon, the U.S. might come to the conclusion that diplomacy has run its course, and that at that time, the U.S. might have to examine its other options for dealing with a nuclear-ready Iran, which are prevention and deterrence. Now, on the one hand, in our study, we didn't rule out prevention, despite the daunting challenges it entails, because we believe that it needs to remain on the table as a credible option in order to bolster diplomacy, and because, as a result of events in the region, it may at one point become necessary. And since this is not something that we believe might happen now, but at some future date, we felt that it would be inappropriate to tie the analysis too closely to current political and military realities. Basically, what we tried to do is provide a framework, an analytical framework, for intelligence analysts, military planners, and policymakers for thinking about this problem. On the other hand, we didn't come out in favor of prevention either, because diplomacy still holds some promise of success, because we don't know whether the U.S. has the target intelligence that is a prerequisite for success in this area, and because prevention involves such sobering, formidable risks and challenges. We did, however, want to provide planners and decision makers with advice as to how to mitigate some of these risks while maximizing the prospects for a successful policy of prevention should they opt for this course of action, in light of the perhaps even greater risks and challenges that a policy of deterring a nuclear Iran could entail. Now, the public debate about prevention has tended to focus on military technical challenges. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that right now, but that's not what our paper is about. We have an appendix where we do discuss some of these, but I just want to make just one or two quick points. First, on the issue of target intelligence, as I said before, accurate target intelligence is the sine qua non for effective prevention. If you don't know what to hit, there's no point in doing it. So that's the absolute sine qua non. Bottom line, as somebody who doesn't have access to the intelligence, I'm not qualified to judge whether we have this capability, and therefore I'm not qualified to say whether this is a viable option. But that's just a fundamental. And I'll just say that the intelligence community's track record, at least as far as we know from outside the government, with regard to WMD intelligence is decidedly mixed. We've had some notable failures and we've had some successes. But I think I have to note that because of Iraq, decision makers are likely to set a very high bar for action. They will insist that the intelligence community be able to state that they have a high degree of confidence in the intelligence they are providing before going down this route. There's issues with regard to weaponeering, the challenges of hitting hardened buried facilities. These are not trivial matters, both in terms of issues related to the geology of the earth above the facility, hardening measures, the performance of penetrator munitions, and the like, and again, also the intelligence picture. So the bottom line is, just looking at the military technical aspect, prevention would entail significant challenges, significant uncertainties, and probably would require multiple strikes over time if it is to impose significant damage and delay on Iran's program, because different aspects of its infrastructure are running on a different timeline, and because if they presumably, or there's a good chance they'll try to rebuild, and therefore, in order to ensure the success of the policy, you might have to hit again. The public debate, however, I mean, by just looking at the amount of destruction and delay imposed, I think, is misleading. And the amount of destruction and delay is probably the criteria for imposed on a particular site is the criteria for measuring the success of the mission, but not for the success of the policy. And to measure the success of the policy, the criteria, the real factor is whether Iran decides to rebuild or not. That is really the crucial consideration. Now, let me just say this. One can never rule out the possibility that a single strike might be followed by an unpredictable series of unrelated events that could result in the suspension of the nuclear program, as occurred with the Israeli strike on Osirak. Who would have thought that a decade later you'd have Iraq invading Kuwait, Operation Desert Storm, and then UN inspections on Iraq's nuclear program? But that's not the basis for a policy, at least I think in the American context. That might be a consideration for Israel. I would argue that's not a sound basis for a policy for the U.S. So seen in this way, preventive action is not a one-off deal, but would by necessity be a prelude to further action, either multilateral diplomacy to press Iran not to rebuild its nuclear program, or additional military strikes to prevent Iran from rebuilding. Therefore, success in prevention should be judged not only in terms of damage done to the nuclear infrastructure and delays imposed, but also whether prevention precludes or facilitates follow-on diplomacy or military action. And I would actually say that, looked at it this way, this approach somewhat raises the bar in terms of the prerequisites for action with regard to the conventional wisdom in the current debate. Moreover, this has implications for any discussion about the possibility that a departing Bush administration could use military action to solve the Iranian nuclear program. Because if such a parting shot is done in a way that undermines domestic and international support for follow-on actions, whether it be diplomacy or military action, then such an act could foredoom such an attempt at a policy of prevention to failure. Moreover, this way of looking at the problem means that success would likely hinge on Washington's ability to craft a sustainable policy that effectively integrates military, diplomatic, and informational instruments of policy to cause, first, maximum destruction to key nodes in the nuclear infrastructure. It is important. It's just not, that's not the be-all and end-all. To mitigate the consequences of Iranian retaliation, that's a second precondition. And third, to set the conditions for successful post-strike diplomacy or military action. Now, first, mitigating Iranian retaliation. We went through in the study a range of possible Iranian responses, probably not exhaustive, but pretty extensive. And we went over things such as Iran might decide to withhold its own oil exports. It might try to disrupt regional oil exports. It might try to attack allied and U.S. assets in the Gulf, such as the Abqaiq oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia, or water desalination plants in the Gulf Cooperation Council states, or U.S. naval assets in the Gulf. It might try to attack U.S. interests in Iraq by ratcheting up military support for Mahdi Army people or the like. It could encourage Hezbollah to attack Israel by launching rockets against Israel. It might seek to attack the Israeli nuclear reactor in Dimona in response, whether or not Israel was involved in a strike. It might seek to respond by terror and subversion in the Gulf and beyond. We also examined the possibility of full-scale war, because there are some people who seem to believe that a preventive strike against Iran will eventually lead to a U.S. invasion of the country, and our conclusion that invasion is off the table, really. But a preventive strike could, if not probably, lead to a protracted low-intensity war of attrition between Iran and the United States. And the bottom line that we come to is that in each case, there are things we can do to mitigate the Iranian response. But in each case, probably only partly mitigate. And there's no avoiding the conclusion that this prevention gets us in a very sticky situation, a very problematic situation with Iran, in which American and allied interests in the region and outside are put at risk. Now, the second consideration, setting the conditions for post-strike diplomacy or military action. For prevention to be successful in setting the conditions for post-strike diplomacy or further military action, use of force has to be seen as legitimate in the U.S., in Europe, and by other actors in the international community. And therefore, as Patrick mentioned in his presentation, situational factors have to be considered. For instance, is Tehran seen as having rebuffed reasonable diplomatic offers? Is diplomacy seen as having run its course? or is diplomacy still seen as having potential? Likewise, was preventive action preceded by provocative actions by Tehran and seen as a justifiable response to these actions, or is preventive action seen as an unjustifiable act of U.S. aggression? Then what is the perceived immediacy and magnitude of the Iranian nuclear threat? What does the IAEA say? Do its assessments complement or contradict official U.S. assessments? How credible are U.S. intelligence community assessments? And what is the reputation of the U.S. administration for its commitment to multilateral diplomacy and the rule of law? And then finally, is Iran seen as merely troublesome or a profoundly destabilizing force? Is deterrence seen as doable or a high-risk policy? In other words, is it possible to live with a nuclear Iran, or is a nuclear Iran seen as an unacceptable threat to the region, to international peace, and to the global non-proliferation regime? It also matters how proliferation is done. How prevention is done. If prevention is done without building a domestic consensus in favor of military action, that could perhaps foredoom attempts, American attempts, to launch follow-on military actions. And then there's another question. Does prevention cause Tehran to further disperse, conceal, and harden its nuclear program, making follow-on strikes much more difficult? The bottom line, we concluded, is that given the legacy of the Iraq War, it is unclear whether these conditions for success can be met, that is, whether preventive action can be done in such a way as to create favorable conditions for post-strike diplomacy or military action, and therefore whether it could form the basis of a sustainable policy. But again, I wanted to stress, we were very careful not to tie our assessments to the current situation, because we're writing an assessment that could possibly remain a basis for thinking about this subject for a year, 2 years, who knows, and the situation in the region. We're going to have a new president in the United States next year. We're going to have perhaps a new president possibly in Iran next year. The situation could change dramatically, and therefore the answers to these questions could change dramatically in the near term. The final thing I just wanted to talk about is the issue of prevention versus deterrence, because I don't believe that you could discuss prevention in a vacuum. It must be examined in light of the other policy option available to the U.S., which is deterrence. If the potential risks, challenges, and consequences of prevention are daunting, the risks, challenges, and possible consequences of a policy of deterrence may be even more so. The cost-benefit calculus pertaining to prevention versus deterrence as a means of dealing with Iran's nuclear program may be one of the most complex and difficult problems facing the U.S., given the uncertainties, again, of the prospects for success and the possible price of failure for each, because deterrence is not an easy low-risk alternative. If one were to juxtapose the risks and benefits of prevention and deterrence, the resulting balance sheet might look something like this. Prevention, on the one hand, entails significant near-term risk of Iranian retaliation for an uncertain outcome whose benefits may be relatively short-lived. That is, imposing delays of only a few years on Iran's nuclear program, unless further military action is taken. Deterrence, on the other hand, defers a crisis but runs very high risks in the long term. Now, some of these risks are incremental. The possibility, for instance, of increased terrorism by Iranian proxies, a return of Tehran's efforts to export the revolution like we saw in the 1980s, and a more assertive regional policy. There's also the risk that Iran's acquisition of nuclear capability could tempt other countries in the Middle East and elsewhere to pursue their own nuclear option, increasing the long-term possibility of nuclear proliferation and nuclear war, not just in the region, but elsewhere in the world as well. And finally, there is the risk that a catastrophic failure of deterrence could lead to the death of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people. Now, we mentioned that, Rob mentioned this monograph that we published last year about comparing the challenges of Cold War deterrence and deterrence today. And one of our conclusions was that deterring Iran is likely to prove much more difficult than nuclear deterrence was during the Cold War for a number of reasons. First has to do with the ability to create an international coalition to deter and contain a nuclear Iran and to sustain such a coalition over decades. I have personally great doubt that this could be done. Secondly, there's the issue of the complex regional security environment, which increases the risk of miscalculation by Iran, especially in the wake of our bungled, at least initially, intervention in Iraq and the badly mishandled Israeli war in Lebanon, which has, in both cases, affected the deterrence status or profile of both countries. Also, given Iran's preference for indirection and dissimulation and deniability, Tehran might be tempted to attempt a covert delivery of a nuclear device or weapon. There's the issue of regime factionalism, which poses command and control problems. The same radical elements that provide support to terrorists, in particular the Revolutionary Guard, also control aspects of Iran's nuclear program, raising the risk that if the system of checks and balances built into the Iranian governmental structure were to weaken, the result might be nuclear terrorism. And then finally, there's the issue of radical regime elements who are not particularly well informed about the outside world. And again, this heightens the potential for miscalculation or rash action. To further complicate matters in looking at prevention versus deterrence, it's important to keep in mind that prevention and deterrence are not necessarily mutually exclusive options. Prevention may delay but may not halt Iran's nuclear program. And in the end, depending on how things work out, prevention may, in the end, turn out to be a detour on the path to deterrence, and a very costly detour at that. Therefore, considering the possible effect of prevention on the stability of a potential deterrence relationship with a nuclear Iran is vitally important. If, after absorbing one or more preventive strikes, Iran succeeds in acquiring nuclear weapons, would the legacy of prevention make for a more or less stable deterrence relationship with a nuclear Iran? Would the legacy of a potentially painful and costly war as a result of prevention incline the leaders of the Islamic Republic to greater prudence and caution in the future than they have practiced in the past? Or would it add an additional layer of complexity to the U.S.-Iranian relationship and create yet another blood debt to be repaid? Finally, it is worth noting that U.S. policymakers have set a very high rhetorical bar with regard to Iran's nuclear program. President Bush has said that Iran with a nuclear weapon is unacceptable. Vice President Cheney has said that the U.S. will not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. And I simply throw out the question, despite these warnings, should Iran succeed in acquiring nuclear weapons, I would suggest that the U.S. might have more difficulty establishing the credibility of future verbal warnings, threats, and red lines, and establishing a stable deterrent relationship with a nuclear-capable Iran than might have otherwise been the case. By way of conclusion, I have to say that there may be no clear-cut answers to the question of the relative costs and benefits of prevention versus deterrence, or at least I'm not capable of doing such a cost-benefit analysis. So how does one cut through the complexity of the problem and avoid what appears to be a prescription for paralysis through analysis? Well, I suspect decision-makers will be tempted to fall back on general principles of foreign policy. Some policymakers might be tempted to cut through the complexity of the problem by basing their decision on a fundamental foreign policy principle of the post-September 11th era, which is the most dangerous nations cannot be allowed to obtain the most dangerous weapons. Others may prefer to avoid an immediate confrontation as well as another Middle East war by eschewing prevention, perhaps hoping that Iran will over time evolve to be less threatening and more accepting of the regional status quo than deterrence can be relied upon, that reliance can be relied upon to keep the peace, and that somehow a nuclear arms race in the region and elsewhere can be averted. Either way, if diplomacy fails, no matter which policy the U.S. chooses, whether it's prevention or deterrence, it will have profound consequences for the future of the Middle East, the international nuclear nonproliferation regime, and for the U.S. place in the world. For this reason, we need to redouble our efforts to find a diplomatic solution to this problem. Thank you.